auditing the world's first crowdfunding festival. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes too. And just ahead, don't miss it as OneSpark co-founder Elton Rivas looks to the next phase. 549-2937 to get on the line now. Then later in the hour, Going Green looks at sustainable fisheries, a topic of concern worldwide and here on the First Coast. Plus, a conversation with Matt Rapp of the Players' Championship. The Players' Week is coming up. And OneJax honors the top humanitarians in town. All of that ahead. But first this morning, it's the OneSpark postmortem. The third annual crowdfunding festival is undergoing an independent audit to determine its impact. After wrapping up its third year in downtown Jacksonville, record crowds and publicity marked as a success. So what tweaks are needed to improve the event for the next time? Well, co-founder Elton Rivas is in studio with his thoughts. He's caught up on sleep, hopefully. And Elton, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much.
Great to have you on the show. And the number to join us as we talk about OneSpark is 549-2937. What would you like to see next year? What did you like? What would you like to see improved? Call us up 549-2937 or online wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Bigger and better than ever this year, it seemed. Good weather, record crowds. So let's lead with the positive. What did you like about this year?
Yeah, I think the overwhelming support from the community. Biggest thing that we had focused on, and I know we had talked about this during the festival and before, was really driving contributions for creators. And, you know, we still have lots of work to do, but when we tally all the numbers, you know, this year there's the $350,000 in the award structure. In addition to that, and, you know, as of about a week ago, we're up over $100,000 in direct contributions for creators as well, with some of those campaigns continuing to run. So, you know, almost $500,000 that is distributed to creators. I think the venture program this year is still underway and still in the works, and that was a big focal point. You know, voting and contributing to the creators was a major piece of this puzzle. Well, enjoying a wonderful festive atmosphere, and there's no doubt that you know, hundreds of thousands of people turned out for that.
With success always comes growing pains, tweaks, changes. As you conduct an independent audit of OneSpark, what are you hoping to get out of that?
Yeah, and we actually, you know, go through a similar process each of the first 2 years. And this year we have surveys that have started going out actually today. And those go out to creators, they go out to jurors, they go out to attendees, you know, to people that voted, contributed, everybody. And when we get that information back, we hope to find things that can help us improve. You know, one theory could be that, you know, this year over 320,000 plus people, is that too big? I don't know. But that's why we do these types of surveys and get that data. And then from there, now that we're in our third year, we have the ability to go back to the creators from the first year and say, hey, where are you at, you know, with your project? Where are you at with job creation and things like that? We've got a lot of anecdotes around that, but it'd be great to assess it and see what the true economic impact is over that period of time here in Northeast Florida.
And we'll go to your calls about OneSpark's postmortem in just a moment at 549-2937. Someone just sent me a link to an article about Yoga for Change. That's the local nonprofit that won big this year at OneSpark, more than $32,000 in cash awards and crowdfunding contributions. She said it changed everything for her business. There are so many great success stories like Yoga for Change that you can point to and really feel excited about. At the same time, there have been critics of OneSpark. In particular, the author of a study sent to me yesterday said that the majority of creators underperform when compared to online crowdfunding platforms. So what's your response to those who feel that as great an event as it as OneSpark is, people don't always get the bang for their buck?
Yeah, and I think, and I'm guessing that was the independent study from Chris Markle.
Right.
And, you know, Chris and I actually sat down briefly after last year's event, had a conversation, and I welcome that feedback. I think our team welcomes that feedback to figure out how we can improve. The good news is that, you know, again, we were over double in contributions what we were last year, which was significantly increased from the first year. But, you know, make no mistake, I mean, we've got a lot of work to do to figure out how to make this one of the most efficient ways to deploy capital and to allow people to meet with people in person. There's, you know, independent surveys that are out there about a lot of different things on crowdfunding as an industry. And you can find arguments on both sides of that coin. One side says this is the most efficient way to do anything as it relates to deploying capital. And another side will say this is the most inefficient way. So it's still a very new industry and a lot to come around that.
And you envisioned it, of course, as a crowdfunding festival. It still is that. But for many people, it's become more than that. The crowdfunding aspect for many people that come to it, that's not at the top of their mind. That is a fact. People come for the fun of it, the excitement of it. Are you okay with that, too?
Don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of good. Absolutely. For people coming downtown, for people to really engage and have this energy that, you know, and we were talking about it just before, there's almost an emotional feel the week after OneSpark of kind of this, you know, post OneSpark depression that sets in, that's like, hey, there's so much energy that's here and we love being part of that. How do we unpackage that and unbundle that for the year? Mm-hmm. So, you know, people coming out, I think that adds to it. We're really, really going to focus on trying to figure out whether or not that detracts too much from connections with great ideas, getting connected to the resources they need, which is ultimately the mission of OneSpark. So to be determined on that. But, you know, 320,000 people, that's a lot of people. Yeah. Also, 6 days, that's a long time. And so, you know, we'll get some of that feedback from creators. Anecdotally, some of them have said, hey, that's too long. You know, we need less.
Let's go to your calls right now. It's the OneSpark postmortem here on First Coast Connect today with co-founder Elton Rivas as the organization looks ahead to next year. What are your thoughts? Did you come out? What were your impressions? 549-2937 is the number to join the conversation. Mike is on the west side. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for taking my call. Do you want me to just jump right in?
Sure.
All right. Well, first off, I'm a big fan of OneSpark, and I think it's absolutely one of the best things that Jacksonville has to offer. And I had a blast last year. I took my kids this year and we had a good time. I think all of the buzz and the energy and the interesting things that drop out, making it fun and whatnot, the more fun you can make it, the more kid-friendly you can make it, the better. I think that's awesome. But I do have a couple of things that I noticed this year, if you want me to pass those along.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, one of my kids, when we went there, before we hit some of the funner stuff, that was there was a video game area where they had a lot of gaming stuff that took their interest. But before that, they were complaining that, oh, it's just a bunch of people talking about their businesses, Dad. And so that's one thing. But then one of the criticisms that I read online and that I talked to a lot of my friends is that it seemed less like creators, per se, people who had bold new ideas, as much as a lot of people with really, really, really lousy small business ideas, really trying to scurry up businesses and or scurry up money for businesses, as well as a lot of, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, by the way, but you know, you had a lot of people basically just out there shilling for their cause, whether it's a business or a nonprofit or a charity or something like that. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but you know, I don't know how you want to gatekeep some of that stuff to ensure that the people, you know, there as creators are truly creators or not. I don't even know if that's worth doing. I don't know if that's something you should do. I can't help walking away feeling, I think a lot of people may feel like there's a little bit of a bait and switchy kind of thing when you get that large number of people. I know you had a lot of creators there, and that's probably a good thing, and you're going to have lame ones as a part of the really awesome ones as well. But do you have any comments towards that, or have you guys heard that criticism?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sure, Mike. Go ahead, Elton.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the call and thanks for the commentary on that. I think, you know, let's speak to kind of the direct feedback piece first, and glad that you and the family had a great time. I think it's really tough, and just being, you know, transparent about this, it's tough because we as OneSpark will help select some of the curators, and then the venues actually pick the creators. And, you know, it's a constant ebb and flow between, is it great quality or is it enough creator projects that are there? One of the conversation topics that's come up within our team and that, you know, we're putting out there in surveys for feedback is, I mean, ultimately, should we pick a core group of people that help select the creators? And have a different focus rather than just the venues doing that? Again, don't know that answer, but that's something that we're very focused on, especially during this next 60 to 90 day period of time when we get that data and that feedback back in. So hear you on that. And that's something that's definitely on our radar. So thanks for the call.
549-2937, Larry's downtown. Hi, Larry. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. I just want to say that OneSpark is a great thing, and it's been very successful, and I think it's a great addition to events downtown. But as someone who works downtown all the time, I'm wondering whether or not there should be some serious consideration about moving it. I think, personally, that it's gotten a little too big for downtown in that the traffic, the gridlock in the traffic is phenomenal. Parking is hard. People that are not participating in OneSpark that have businesses downtown can't get deliveries. They can't get people to service them, and even though it's a great event, and I wouldn't want to see anything happen to it, but I think some serious thoughts ought to be given into whether or not it could be moved to a site where there's plenty of parking, plenty of area for people to walk around and do their thing. And, you know, that's basically my comment. This year, traffic was the worst it's ever been. Of course, it was a bigger event, but they had roads blocked off and things blocked off that really shouldn't have been blocked off. It was maybe one event on one road, and the whole road was blocked off. And because of that, you had to go 3 blocks one way, 4 blocks another, and then come back. I just think it's gotten the success of it has gotten too large for the core of downtown.
All right, Larry, thank you. Let's talk about that.
Sure. Elton. Yeah, and I think, you know, to kind of build on the comment that you ended with success comes new challenges. And so, you know, this is the first time that, you know, we've had over 300,000 people for an event in the urban core of our city. And, you know, we're talking about the scale of something that, you know, mimics something like the Super Bowl in only its third year. And so I think, you know, to your point, there's probably a lot of learnings, and we've got attendee surveys that have gone out as well. So, you know, if you're on our mail list, if you get that survey, please, please, please give us that feedback so that we can continue to take those in note and figure out how we can do better moving forward.
But going to his other comment, the whole point of OneSpark is to get people to come downtown. So that's not, you would not consider moving it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of OneSpark is to connect great ideas with the resources they need. And we do that in downtown. And it's a wonderful byproduct to have that many people come to downtown. You know, we take everything into consideration. Then we stack those against pros and cons after we get that data from the surveys.
Oh, so you might consider moving it to another location.
I'm not going to say we would or we wouldn't until we get that data.
You're a data-driven guy. I know.
Absolutely.
That. 549-2937. Dennis is in Pontevedra. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, how you doing? Before my question, it has to stay downtown. I remember when in Austin, when South by Southwest first started, part of the whole thing is it's got to be a community and build the downtown atmosphere of Jacksonville. So anyway, you guys will figure that out, I'm sure, the parking and everything. But I'm curious about next year as far as how much does it cost for a creator to apply, and is it has early enrollment started for next year's OneSpark yet? Or sorry for not knowing any of this stuff, but I'm just curious.
Sure, no problem. Early enrollment hasn't started yet. In the past, it's cost under $100 for a creator to register for the opportunity to be matched at OneSpark with a venue or by a curator. Last year, I think we announced the date sometime late summer. We're probably on a similar schedule to that. But the best way to keep up to date is to go to onespark.com, get on our email list, and we send out information to all the different folks, you know, when key dates are coming up.
549-2937. Marie is at the Beaches. Hello, Marie. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love OneSpark. I didn't go this year. I went the year before. I think part of the reason I didn't go back this year was when I went last year, I'm very excited about entrepreneurship and about these creator ideas, but the feeling I got when I was there was it was more of just a street festival. The kind of people walking around, and it seemed more commercial in a sense to me, and I didn't get the real feeling of that kind of creative venue, which is what I was really looking for. And I know the one feedback that I got from a friend of mine that did go this year is he said he felt really disappointed because he felt more like he was walking down the street constantly being handed cards by people saying, vote for me, vote for me, vote for me, and it just didn't have like that depth, I guess. What we were looking for is in looking for great new ideas and entrepreneurship and that creativity. I love the venue downtown. It's a great place to go if you're just looking for me. It just seems like a more of a street festival than it was really that creative energy, which was the feedback that I got after the first year, and I was really excited to go. And I just kind of walk away with that feeling. And I'll take comments up here.
All right, thank you, Marie.
Yeah, and you know, it's great to hear that kind of feedback, year over year comparisons. One thing that we've looked at, and again, you know, data driven here, but EdSpark as a venue, it was 2 years now running, so we've got some things that we can look at year over year. It was organized, you know, by the Schultz Center, and it was focused on education creators. And there is definitively, it seemed at least anecdotal, there's a different feel in going into something that was organized by creator type rather than just walking down Laura Street as a mm-hmm. festival. And there's kind of two different elements that are there. We learned a lot in Berlin last year. We had, you know, 50 creator projects. It was an intimate venue and an intimate setting, and by no doubt there was a lot more ability to engage because you could walk around and see every single person within a day's time. So I think those are things that we're going to work really hard on this cycle to try to figure out how we make it more efficient and focused on that mission. So thank you for the call.
Michelle in Springfield, lots of calls for OneSpark founder Elton Rivas today. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, I actually just wanted to say congratulations. I thought it was the best OneSpark yet. A lot of the creators were already out in the market and doing really well already. So I've heard some of the calls that had some negative feedback, and I just wanted to say my congratulations because I thought it was just fabulous this year.
Thank you so much for that. And huge thanks to all of our volunteers and to our entire staff and team that put this together. You know, it was a huge undertaking this year, but thank you so much for that feedback. It doesn't go unheard, and it's very welcomed.
And lots of emails and tweets coming in about OneSpark. Scott emails the show, who won OneSpark this year? I know Rethreaded won in previous years. Actually, there was more than one winner this time, right?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount. And you can get all the preliminary results. Just go to onespark.com, click on preliminary results, and everything's listed right there for juried awards and top voted.
And lots of tweets. Brian tweets the show and tweets Elton, I'd like to see more vetting next time. Currently, there's a creator overload. How about the top 50 to 100? Here's a tweet from our own book club blogger, Stacey Goldring. We enjoyed great free speech censorship conversations with our project band. We raised awareness and garnered momentum. And then Brooks tweets the show, what are the dates for next year?
Don't know dates for next year yet. You know, again, we announced those late last summer. And to Brian's tweet, you know, I'd love to get clarification. Keep tweeting at me. But what do you mean by top 50 to 100? If we could get some more information about that, let's have a conversation on Twitter and figure out what we can do.
Yeah, because you're trying to provide a platform and access for hundreds of local startups, and not just local startups. People traveled from all over the country and even overseas to be part of this.
Yeah,
so
we had about 30% of the creator projects that came in from outside of the market this year, which was the biggest that it's been. We had a lot of local entrepreneurs and startups and nonprofits and projects that were there as well. So, you know, huge points in different areas of feedback. And one other point just to share, and, you know, we've seen a lot of chatter around this, is the music category. And the music category is something that, you know, we need to figure out how we can continue to improve upon. It's hard. You've got a musician that's right next to somebody trying to pitch, and then, you know, they go and they play in the evenings, and there's just a lot of confusion around that. So I think that's one particular area that we've seen a lot of noise around.
People, not everyone was happy with who won the music category.
And, you know, there was some chatter around that as well, of being, you know, what type of music they were presenting and those types of things. So again, that's the reason that we have these surveys out there, and we encourage all of the creators to send, you know, their feedback in for that so that we can continue to help improve. And last year, and we'll do the same this year, we actually held a focus group with about 40 to 50 creators, and we'll do that here in the near future so that we can have a much more intimate conversation and in-depth about, you know, those types of opportunities.
But it's the price of success. With success comes changes, feedback, always naysayers, growing pains. But kudos, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Elton Rivas, one of the co-founders of OneSpark. Much more still ahead later. OneJax honors this area's top humanitarians. But up next, in Going Green, how the commercial fishing industry is getting into sustainability before it's too late. That's next.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than half of Americans believe same-sex couples should be allowed to get married, but a number of states have banned such unions. Analysis of arguments in a case before the Supreme Court on whether the Constitution guarantees the right to marry a same-sex partner.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
This Friday on Closing the Loop, George Eckenrode has done a lot of things, from playing trumpet with the OJs to database programming. But spinning on an exercise bike to save his life might be the most fun of all. Closing the Loop, Fridays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered on 89.9 WJCT.
Closing the Loop is sponsored in part by First Coast Home Pros, local specialists in carpet, grout, and upholstery cleaning.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM, from classical to country.
Give me a word, give me a sign, show me where to look and tell me what will I find.
Welcome back. Well, it's a growing question for everyone who loves seafood. Understanding the importance of fisheries conservation, responsible and sustainable commercial fishing practices, sourcing local seafood and tracing it to ensure that seafood that you eat in the restaurant or that you buy at the store is the real deal. How can we ensure safe and responsibly harvested seafood, especially when recent headlines prove that some of the seafood in our supply chain was fished under conditions of modern-day slavery? Food consultant Jeff Spear of Studio Spear Farm joins us here in studio with his thoughts. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And on the line, TJ Tate, Director of Seafood Sustainability for the National Aquarium in Baltimore. TJ, good morning to you.
Good morning, guys. Morning, Jeff. Morning, Melissa.
And TJ and Jeff are here with us in today's Going Green. We want your calls about the growing push towards sustainable commercial fishing practices around the world. 549-2937 is the number to join the show. Jeff Spear, let's begin with you. As a food consultant and a food marketer, you've really become an advocate on this topic, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we're hearing nowadays everyone talks about authenticity of the food, local, sustainability. They're becoming meaningless buzzwords. And how you sort through all that to find who are the people that are actually providing the truly sustainable, the truly high integrity products, it's hard to figure out. And in seafood, it's even worse because we don't have any branding that goes with it.
And TJ Tate, we should point out you're on the phone with us from Baltimore because, of course, Baltimore has had some unrest and is under a curfew due to rioting in that city. We appreciate you still being on the program with us. You're director of seafood sustainability for the National Aquarium in Baltimore. So this is top of mind for you as well, correct?
Most definitely. This is a very culture-rich area full of heritage and watermen. And when you think the Maryland region, you think Chesapeake Bay. And so it is something that's very top of mind, even though right now most folks are thinking of this region for the unrest that we've had. But just so you know, the city is back to life, and people are shopping and being normal citizens today, and they've called for peace. So we're happy to see a vibrant city getting back to life.
That's wonderful to hear. And you you divide your time between Baltimore and the First Coast, right?
I do. I still have a home in St. Augustine, and always will. Love my fishermen who work in the Gulf of Mexico, as well as the First Coast.
Okay, and we'll go to your calls in today's Going Green on sustainable seafood in a moment at 549-2937. Jeff Spear, as we discuss this, this is such a topical issue because not only are we seeing shortages of seafood all over the world, slave-caught seafood is clouding our supply networks. Seafood that you can buy in a supermarket or eat at a restaurant, there is a decent chance it was caught by someone working under slave-like conditions, which is so horrifying for American consumers to read and know about.
Yeah, I mean, with seafood, unless you're buying something in the freezer case, you don't know who makes it or who fished it or what countries it came from. I mean, I'm originally from Baltimore as well, just coincidence with me and TJ, and I grew up eating crab, and Maryland crab is distinctly different from crab from anywhere else in the world. But when you go to the supermarket and buy fish, it's just slabs of fish on ice. You don't know origin. They're starting to get better about it, but you don't know. I've been an advocate of branding fish, so there is some traceability that way. And then one of the reasons that I got involved with TJ's is there's this very cool traceability system in the Gulf. It's called Gulf Wild, and they have these little tags that are like the supermarket tags you put on your keychain. And they break apart into three parts. They when the fish are caught, they attach them to the gills of the fish. The fisherman records the data into this Gulf Wild database. It says where the fish were caught, how they were caught, what the species is, a lot of data. And with these little tags, you can break off pieces, and they have QR codes. And eventually, the idea is a restaurateur can buy the fish, it still has the tag. They can break off the tag, put it on the plate with the fish, and then the diners, in the age of cell phones, you can break out the phone, you know, hit the QR code and get all kinds of information about the fish you're eating.
TJ, is this type of idea something that can be executed? And how do you see this industry rising to meet these kinds of demands?
Well, the Gulf Wild system was a system that I helped create with the fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico. And I have to say that for commercial fishermen, predominantly reef fish fishermen, this type of a program has had huge success. So it's now traceable from the boat literally to the plate. And I know that you hear that a lot in verbiage with folks. But a consumer can feel safe in knowing where that seafood has come from. And we originally started down this line with tagging our fish after the oil spill because people had concerns of, was the seafood safe? Was it caught in an oil-free zone versus an oil zone? And so we had an immediate need to start tagging those fish to really give people an idea of where the fish was caught. But more importantly, we established Gulf Wild based on responsibility of harvest principles. So all of the participants in the program sign what are called conservation covenants that says that they will fish more responsibly. They're not going to throw back their bycatch. They are going to, abide by all and any regulations. They are going to try to retain their harvest to bring it to market, work in cooperative research to solve problems, be accountable for their catch, those kind of things. And it's working in the Gulf of Mexico, and I see it starting to take hold in other regions. It won't be the exact same model, but from a traceability and responsibility standpoint, I think all watermen and fishermen alike want to see the same type of progress. And having that consumer understanding and awareness and comfortability of purchasing that seafood.
549-2937, as we discuss sustainable and responsible commercial fishing practices in today's Going Green. CJ is downtown. Hi, CJ.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to get the panel's thoughts on aquaculture and also aquaponics, which is the combination of aquaculture and hydroponics, which essentially the fish act like fertilizer factories in providing chemical-free, all-natural way for plants to grow. The best part is it only uses about 2-3% of the water that is with traditional agricultural methods, and would definitely help in water-starved areas like California. Thank you.
Thanks, CJ. Jeff?
CJ, this is
TJ.
Let TJ go.
Go ahead, TJ.
CJ, thanks for your question. This is TJ, and it's a very timely and an awesome question. I have always worked with commercial wild-caught fishermen, and since my transition up here to the Chesapeake area, the most sustainable source of seafood is oyster aquaculture farming. As you know, oysters are filter feeders, and so the more oysters that we can put back in the bay, we're not only helping the bay, but we're helping the oyster industry, and it's become a very clean, economically, biologically sound way of farming for these watermen where they have not had that resource. From an aquaponic standpoint, I love the direction that you're going with it. I think it's going to be the wave of the future, especially with water shortages, with food security issues. And I think we need to look outside of that box even greater and look at things like seaweed, because seaweed, especially if you're thinking somewhere up, like in my region now in the Chesapeake Bay, has huge potential from an aquaculture standpoint. So great question. And I think it is the fastest industry right now in all of fisheries.
And Josh tweets the show, sustainability means thinking about the nexus between economic, environmental, and social spheres. Can your guest comment on all three?
These days, people are getting more and more concerned about the integrity of the food they eat. You know, we're hearing about, I think it was a week or so ago, Kraft did a recall because there was metal in their macaroni and cheese. Now they're taking out the artificial colorings. Why isn't this happening anyway? I mean, I look at lots of packages and there are ingredients on there. Now, some of them have funny names and they're actually natural, but most of them have funny names and they come from funny places. So why these producers aren't starting with this idea of integrity and quality? I know they're financial issues, but why they don't work this out, I don't quite understand. And then, you know, consumers want to know that what they're eating is going to actually nourish them the way they expect, that it has the nutritional qualities, that it has, you know, just the food qualities, that it's not something that's going to taste wrong.
Marisol in Mandarin. Hi, Marisol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call, Melissa. I have a logistical question, I guess. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the tagging system because I know a lot of fish have more than one fillet. How are you able to ensure that each fish has enough tags for that fish? I'm just a little confused about how it works exactly.
Sure. TJ.
So the fish were originally caught with just one tag, and then we had a weight for the fish, and we knew approximately how many fillets were going to come out of that fish. We had the same question that you did of how do we approve upon this, tagging the whole fish is really easy, but not everybody wants to buy a whole fish, and certainly when you go into a restaurant, that's not what you're getting. So that's why the tag scenario that Jeffrey mentioned was brought up, so that essentially for every fish caught, and right now we're talking about
red snapper, red grouper, the entire grouper complex, tile fish. These are fish that the yield coming out of them is not going to, you're not going to typically have more than three fillets that are going to come from these fish. And with the tagging system that we currently have, based on weight of when they're cut, a portion of that tag will go with each fillet. And when we designed the tag, we looked at it from that perspective. You know, with the size of fish that we know that we typically catch, and usually they're going to be three tags is going to be sufficient for the fillets that are going to come off those fish. If we should ever be tagging something much larger, such as a tuna, for example, most people think of something large, then we'd have to be looking at a tag of a different scale.
And TJ, we need to point out you are the winner of the 2014 Seafood Champion Awards.
TJ.
Pretty exciting. This is such a fascinating topic and one so many of our listeners care about. So thank you both so much for joining the show.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Most definitely. Thank you for listening to me on the phone.
Sure. And we were joined by Jeff Spear of Studio Spear and TJ Tate, Director of Seafood Sustainability for the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And we're back in a moment.
This Going Green segment brought to you by Bug Out Service. Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Jacksonville has distinct neighborhoods with unique issues and priorities, including growth, crime, traffic, and investment. Find out where the candidates stand. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present a debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry. Listen to Face to Face, Brown versus Curry, Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet,
and who doesn't,
we're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Welcome back. Well, the Players' Championship is almost here. Are you heading out for it? I've got a preview of this year's big event as we welcome Executive Director Matt Rapp. Matt Rapp, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, as always.
So lots to discuss with the Players' Championship just around the corner. Every year it seems to get more popular with more features and more fun things to do. What are you most excited about this year?
There's so many new things here. It's the same vein as we've done over the last couple of years, but only more so. So the entire area behind 16 Green and 17 Tee has been transformed. It's gone from, frankly, one of the ugliest spots on the course for spectators to one of the nicest It's anchored by a bathroom, of all things, but it's really lovely set up. And the foliage they put around it and the landscaping, just outstanding. New views and vantage points on 16T and 10T, and new mounds on 16 green and 9 green for fan viewing. We're doubling the size of Tacos on 12 with Taco Lou, and Wine and Dine on 9 with Madure. Lots of new changes.
And, of course, Tiger Woods announcing he'll play this year. That'll certainly drive some extra crowds, right?
Absolutely. We set records last year when he was out injured, so the tournament's really grown beyond any one person.
Right.
But it certainly helps to have him.
And you know, this is such a social occasion on the First Coast. People love the golf. They love to watch the players, but they also like to network. They like to party. People really look forward to this. And what advice do you have for people that want to make the most out of their experience this time?
Well, I think you're right. There's a lot of business going on here. There's a lot of socializing. There's a lot of catching up. I hear people all the time say, you know, I see people one time a year, and it's at the Players' Championship. It's so great to catch up with them and reconnect and, you know, reestablish old friendships, et cetera. I think a couple of things that are on our list. We have moved Military Appreciation Day from Wednesday to Tuesday. We don't want a bunch of people coming out here on Wednesday saying, when's the Big and Rich concert? Because we won't know. They will have played last night, and that's not a great answer. So plan your days, you plan your week around Tuesday being Military Appreciation. The other is parking and transportation. We are expecting record crowds, especially Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and to a slightly lesser extent on Sunday. So plan on how you're going to get out here. Hopefully taking one of the shuttle buses from downtown or one of the clubs that are out here at the beach or carpooling are your answers. We'd like to get as many people out here as possible, but conveniently, safely, and without a lot of undue stress on the traffic load.
Sure. And as you said, there's a Military Appreciation Day. There's also a day for executive women. That's been a factor for a few years, too, right?
Yes, we're going to have another one here. It's been very successful. We've been able to expand it. We're in a new venue this year that allows a few more seats in there. And it's sold out again, as we have every year that we've had it. So that's on Monday, so a week from today, and has been a great addition to the tournament.
Anything else people need to keep in mind?
Well, I just think that it's a wonderful day out here, but we want everyone to have a safe and fun time. Coastal Cab is our cab company. If you maybe have socialized a little too hard, which we are not encouraging, but if you happen to find yourself in that situation, please do the right thing and call a cab and get home safely. I think the other thing is just it's a little hot out here in May, so there are lots of ways to cool down. We have cooling benches. We have air-conditioned venues that are open to anyone with a grounds pass, a new shaded bleacher on 16T and 10T. There's also other places that are in the shade where most of our fan zones are, so you can recharge, get something cold to drink, and get on with your day. But if you're starting to feel that heat stroke, et cetera, feeling a little overtaxed, make sure you get some water and make sure you get to one of our first aid tents. Sunscreen is always advisable. We have complimentary sunscreen in all of the upgraded bathrooms, courtesy of MD Anderson Cancer Center. And so just, you know, be smart about how you enjoy your day out here.
Matt Rapp, a pleasure as always. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me.
Get out and enjoy the Players Championship. And finally this hour, well, this year marks the 45th anniversary of an annual event honoring some of this area's brightest lights. It's the One Jacks Humanitarian Awards Dinner coming up on April 30th, tomorrow. This year, the event will look back at the legacy of all the honorees who've been recognized over the years. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Nancy Bronner, One Jacks Executive Director and honoree, Audrey Moran. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And good to see you both. Hard to believe that this is the 45th anniversary, Nancy. That's pretty exciting.
It's really exciting. We're very much looking forward to having Jacksonville reflect on 45 years of contributions of these wonderful people.
And Audrey Moran, you're an honoree, so congratulations. Very well deserved.
Thank you. What an honor. It's very humbling, and the people that are being honored this year along with me and for the 44 years before, what a great cross-section of our community.
Yeah. And that's what this is about. Not only will you honor people from this year, right, Nancy? You're going to make mention of people through the years. Can
yes.
you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think it's important for our community to value humanitarian work and to look to the role models over the past 45 years to consider the contribution they made to creating a wonderful culture of our city. So we're very much excited about a lot of the honorees returning so that we can highlight the work they did.
Can you throw out just a few names over the decades people might recognize?
Oh, sure. So we have, I mean, a lot of these are always part of our dinner. Bob Shercliffe is a community treasure. Fran Kinney participated in this dinner preparations. We have, 45 years of people who continue to be engaged in our work. And so we have a special tribute for all of them.
Let's talk about One Jacks, too. Just the mission of One Jacks for people who aren't familiar with the organization. It used to be called something else, right?
It did. It was originally founded as the National Conference for Christians and Jews.
Yeah.
And then expanded its mission and became National Conference for Community and Justice. And then in the mid-2000s, Jacksonville's own local chapter became One Jacks.
And the idea, Audrey, is to bring people together.
Very much so. And it's across ethnicity, religion, gender. Inclusion is the operative word when it comes to One Jacks. The fundamental belief is our diversity is our strength, and celebrating that diversity and using it for good in our community is what One Jacks is all about. And it's an organization that should be a real point of pride for this community.
And in your capacity as Director of Corporate Responsibility and Social Responsibility at Baptist Health, that's something you're focused on.
We really are. As an anchor institution, not only in healthcare, but in the corporate world in Jacksonville, we have a real responsibility to give back to the community. And we work hard to do that in a variety of ways, whether it's financial investment, investment of resources that are people and talent, but working together with organizations across this city to improve quality of life. Nobody can do it alone. And One Jacks is one of those organizations that helps all of us, whether it's Baptist Health, Haskell, one of the other great corporations in our community, come together and say, when we work together, we can do a lot more.
And this dinner, obviously, Thursday night is a huge celebration, Nancy, but what are some of the other initiatives One Jacks undertakes throughout the year?
So we are engaged in community forums such as the Civil Discourse Series. This is in a partnership with WJCT and the Florida Times Union and Human Rights Commission. And we have come together to create opportunities to model civil discourse on sometimes controversial topics. This is something that our entire country is concerned about, the polarity of our opinions and the inability to listen to opinions that are perhaps opposite of yours. So we do hold these forums. We do forums on race relations. We worked in collaboration actually also with WJCT and the Human Rights Commission on programs on race relations, Race in the River City, Project Breakthrough. We do interfaith forums. We do forums about LGBT issues, any issues in our city that would add to the culture of inclusion and diversity. We want to have a more respectful and inclusive Jacksonville.
A very worthy goal. So tomorrow night's the big event. Is it too late for people to grab a ticket?
We are sold out.
Sold out.
Yes. We have almost 700 people coming tomorrow night.
And Audrey will be honored along with, let's see, Cindy Adelman. Silver medallions are Audrey Moran, Gary Chartrand, Charlene Taylor-Hill, and Cindy Watson.
Yes, a wonderful crowd that we can shine a spotlight on the great contributions they've made.
Well, thanks for this wonderful preview. Have a great time. And Audrey, congratulations. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Nancy Bronner is the executive director of One Jacks. Audrey Moran is one of the honorees that will be celebrated at their 45th annual Humanitarian Awards dinner. It's tomorrow night, and that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers this morning. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have questions or feedback about the show, we always want to hear it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, more than half of Americans believe same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. But a number of states have banned such unions. Analysis of oral arguments in the case before the Supreme Court on whether the Constitution guarantees the right to marry a same-sex partner. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.